From Maryland to Alaska, Virginia to Wyoming, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, test scores for American high school students have remained stagnant for nearly two decades. Dr. Matthew Meehan of Hillsdale College is here to explain why. House Democrats have drafted two articles of impeachment against President Trump. Neither allege an actual crime. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. The proposed U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement is queued up for a vote in Congress. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Dan Eikenson of the Cato Institute. And in light of the Inspector General's report, it is obvious there was a deep state effort to prevent Donald Trump from becoming president. On his American Radio Journal commentary, Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, says those responsible must be held accountable. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Recently released international student test scores finds academic achievement by U.S. students remains stagnant, this despite billions more being poured into public education. Here to discuss the report's results and why progress is not being made is Dr. Matthew Meehan. He is Director of Academic Programs at Hillsdale College's Kirby Center in Washington, D.C. Matthew, welcome to American Radio Journal. Doctor, before we start talking about the results of the international test, our listeners are likely not familiar with it. Can you tell us what is the test, who administers it, what is it meant to show?
It's the Program of International Student Assessment, or PISA, or as I like to call the Leaning Tower of PISA, is a sort of international assessment that's administered every 3 years. It's designed to measure 15-year-olds in math, reading, and science. That's basically what it is, so we have to wait for the results to come out. And the last one that was administered was in 2018 to 79 countries. And so now we've got the results are finally in.
And those results, as they measure academic achievement or progress in countries around the world, the United States, how did we fare on the test, and are our students making progress?
We didn't fare very well, and we didn't fare very well in a variety of ways. We did go up very slightly in science. We flatlined or dropped sort of statistical anomaly versions in reading and math. But none of it was, the movement wasn't really the news. We more or less stayed right where we've been in performance and right where we've been for 20 years. But everybody, our ranking went up, which is, some people were touting is a good thing. But we've actually fallen further behind a lot of our own competitor nations, and everybody has been dropping badly. It's not good news for American education, frankly.
And those numbers have been stagnant now for almost two decades. So if we look at the amount of money, Doctor, that has been poured into education, not only K through 12, but at the higher education level, education expenditures have been increasing far more rapidly than the rate of inflation during that period of time. Why is it all that money is getting poured into education, but our numbers are stagnant?
Depends on which institutions we're talking about, but if we're talking about the 15-year-olds that are taking this test, I think it has a lot to do with a lot of bad ideological educational theories that are essentially being papered over with a giant Band-Aid of more and more cash per student. And that's sort of staunching the bleeding, but it's not actually helping the students. So we're trying to fix the problem with money. If you look at higher ed, that's sort of a different question and has to do with a sort of grab bag of goodies from easy-to-get federally-backed loans to also just a massive expenditure on staff and deans and administrators, which has exploded, I think, some horrifying number. I will give you an exaggeration, but it's like something shocking, like 4,000% increase in administrative deans and staff, and the ratio of faculty to staff has used to be that it was the majority of the personnel at a college were faculty, and now the supermajority are administrative deans and staff. So there's just been misappropriations in different ways. But I think for this program of international student assessment, looking at these 15-year-olds, I really think it's educational ideology.
You have put forth the thought that a lack of character development is leading to these slow test scores. Lack of character development, are we talking about work ethic? Are we talking about attitude, approach? What are we talking about there?
Sort of a combination, and I think there are other systemic problems outside the schools that the schools might not be responsible for. Stable mother and father home, like that statistically they know that when a family stays together, the educational outcomes for those students are much better. But even when you filter that out, the schools themselves, their own curricula, are sort of have been leached of their moral character. And so let me try and lay it out just by talking about one idea, the liberal arts, right, which is an important part of education. But what liberal arts has become is exactly what this test is testing. Reading, can you do science, can you do maths? Well, the liberal arts were originally, right, grammar, logic, rhetoric, and a host of other matters in the math and sciences, but also law and character. That is to say, they used to be called the arts of liberty. That is to say, they were geared towards self-government of both yourself in character, like how do you actually live your life well, and then self-government, how do you live in a free society with other people in a republic.
As we look at especially higher education today, a lot of folks look at this and say, are colleges and universities, not all, but a lot of universities, a lot of professors, the concern is that students are being taught what to think rather than how to think. Are our college and universities, and it's hard, I know, to paint with a broad brush, but are we really teaching people how to think these days, or are speech codes and political correctness really running rampant?
It's interesting. I think that how to think and what to think are actually bonded together, that when you learn how to think, suddenly certain things become true, right? So, like, oh, I know how to think about this, and this thing would be thought about this way, and so this thing is this way. So what to think and how to think, I think, are linked. And so it's a good strategy to focus on how to think so that people actually think about the right things and have good opinions and know things are true. I mean, for instance, biological life, what is it? That's a serious question. And it's not just how to think, it's what is biological life. So in one sense, the higher education has essentially forgotten how to think and now has embraced a whole host of really bad what to thinks. But I think you, in order to sort of reform and return to sanity in that regard, I think you have to do both. You actually have to say, look, here's how to think. But when you know how to think, there are a series of things that are true, and we have to engage those. So it's kind of a combination. In one sense, when you're that lost, I don't fault you for trying to come up with some kind of system of things that are true. It just happens to be not true, and that's a big problem.
We have been talking with Dr. Matthew Meehan. He is Director of Academic Programs at the Kirby Center, which is Hillsdale University's Washington, D.C. campus. Matthew, tell us a little bit about Hillsdale College, about the Kirby Center, and also where can folks go on the web to learn more?
They can go to hillsdale.edu, which is the main college website. We've got all kinds of things there. They can learn more about what we're doing in Washington, D.C. at dc.hillsdale.edu. Hillsdale is a very old and very excellent liberal arts college out in Hillsdale, Michigan, and was founded by Free Will Baptist, was put forward to help train citizens for intelligent piety and excellent citizenship.
Dr. Matthew Meehan of Hillsdale College. Doctor, thank you for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. They're based in Washington, D.C., where, of course, impeachment are the top topics of the day. So we're going to have to talk about that this week. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Loman.
We have Democrats in Congress. They have drafted articles of impeachment. Want to give us a rundown, Scott, on what's happened over the last few days?
This week, the House Democrats finally introduced their articles of impeachment. And I think for some of these Democrats on the left that were really hoping to damage the president and find a process where he could be removed from the Senate for committing a crime, well, man, they got to be pretty disappointed, because one of the big things about these articles of impeachment is they don't even accuse the president of committing any crime. The first article says that the president abused his power, and the second article says that he obstructed Congress. And the bottom line is that's basically that they just don't like him, and they don't like the way that he operates as a president. From the moment he was elected in November of 2016 up until now in December of 2019, the Democrats have been doing everything that they can to get him out of office. You had the Mueller investigation, and what's resulted from the Mueller investigation for these impeachment articles? Nothing. Nothing from the Mueller investigation made it into the articles of impeachment, and basically they are centering their entire effort around the idea that he abused his power in asking Ukraine to investigate the Bidens while President Trump is possible to face Joe Biden in a general election. I mean, there's an entire primary to be handled here on the Democrat side, so that's certainly presumption. And then the second one, when you say you obstruct Congress, well, there are separation of powers, but did anybody expect President Trump to come and testify and to yield executive privilege over to the Democrats that have been really just trying to hammer him for the last 3 years? I certainly didn't expect it. And so I think that having an article on obstruction of Congress, that's just sort of ridiculous.
When you talk about abuse of power, isn't abuse of power like a lot of things in the eye of the beholder, like they say about beauty? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Abuse of power, the president says he didn't abuse power. And if you look at it, there's no definitive answer to it. So how do you end up with an article of impeachment on abuse of power when it's not really something you can prove or disprove?
Yeah, and certainly how would the Senate adjudicate that? Would they say, okay, are we going to remove the president from office for abusing power? Well, you know, I would encourage all your listeners right now to take a deep breath through their nose and just see what it smells like, right? Does this pass the smell test? And the reality is that an impeachment and conviction of the president of the United States, the way that the founders envisioned this process of impeachment, it was really supposed to be high crimes and misdemeanors, treason, things like that. And the reality is that this is a political exercise. That's why I think that you're even seeing many House Democrats that are so concerned about their political future that they've wanted to shift the conversation away from impeachment and over to censorship. That's obviously not happening, but I do think that there are vulnerabilities on the left's argument to impeach the president, and it's just not going to hold any ground when it gets over to the Senate. Obviously, today we're making a pretty strong assumption that this is a fait accompli and that Pelosi is going to hold the line with her Democrats and that they actually will convict the president. But this is nothing like the impeachment of President Bill Clinton. It's nothing like the impeachment of President Andrew Johnson. It's nothing like the investigation of President Nixon, who resigned prior to being impeached. This is honestly a political witch hunt, to use the words of President Trump. And the Democrats, they've got nothing. They've got no evidence. I kind of wonder what kind of precedent this sets going forward for any future president, Republican or Democrat or independent or anybody just holding that highest office in our system of government. What does it mean to have political enemies in one branch of government, and where they will do anything, including damage the United States of America and our government institutions over the long term to take out somebody like President Trump, who they have big personality disagreements with, who they have not been able to prove has committed any crime, and certainly they've tried to dig here and there, and they've subpoenaed thousands and hundreds of thousands of pages of emails and brought forth many witnesses. Some witnesses have conflicted their own testimony before Congress. Others have finally gotten to the witness stand and basically said, yeah, you know, I don't have any firsthand evidence. So the bottom line here is that President Trump has faced a Democrat machine that is unwilling to accept the election results of 2016. President Trump also has seen his own polling dramatically improve in many of the swing states. Pennsylvania is one of them. Your home state of Pennsylvania, he's looking better in that state than he was prior to the impeachment effort. So I think the American people are waking up. They understand what sort of a witch hunt this is and how this is only a political exercise. The president committed no crimes. There are no crimes in the articles of impeachment that they've drafted. And that's where we stand today.
So we go over to the United States Senate now, Scott, and it's almost a foregone conclusion. Well, it is a foregone conclusion. The Senate is not going to convict the president on this. So knowing that, does this not just make the whole exercise a giant waste of time and money?
It has been a giant waste of time and money. So this is the process that Mitch McConnell wants to have in the Senate. He wants to have a full process to fully clear President Trump from any wrongdoing. And he's not just going to do a motion to dismiss the articles of impeachment once they're sent over by the House of Representatives. Instead, he's probably going to go through a process where he will move to acquit President Trump and clear him of all these accusations, making sure that the American people know that the president is innocent, he didn't commit any crimes, and he's been acquitted by the Senate.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. We have over 250,000 members from all 50 states in the country. And our membership is united in economic freedom and liberty. If your listeners are interested in checking us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
After much delay, it appears Congress is set to act on the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement. But is USMCA a better deal than the North American Free Trade Agreement, or NAFTA, which it replaces? To find out, Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Dan Eikenson from the Cato Institute. Eric?
Democrats in Congress and the White House reached an agreement this week to pass President Donald Trump's rewrite of the NAFTA trade deal. The rewrite, of course, is called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or the USMCA. It is a huge trade deal that will further unite the three major economies in North America. And the deal this week between the White House and Congress likely means that it could be ready to be approved by Congress before the end of the year or early in 2020. But what does it mean? That's what we're taking a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Dan Eikenson. He is the director of trade policy studies at the Cato Institute. He's been closely following, really for the past year or more, everything that goes on with this USMCA negotiation. And we're glad to have him back here on the show again. Dan, thanks for taking some time to join us.
My pleasure, Eric.
Dan, as I said, it's really been almost a year, a little more than a year, actually, since President Donald Trump and the executives of Mexico and Canada inked the first version of this trade deal. But then, of course, it has to be approved by Congress, and that requires renegotiation and some additional rewriting and all of that. We finally have a deal that looks like it'll get the USMCA through the House. There's a lot of details here, obviously too much for us to get through in this short interview, but just taking it at the high level, the big thing here is that it sort of removes the uncertainty about whether this process is going to go through. Is that really the big development this week?
Yeah, and I think that was the biggest selling point for the USMCA over the NAFTA. The fact that we've been hanging in limbo there for a long time was lengthening the duration of uncertainty and it's kind of probably deterring investment. And so it's good to get this behind us. And in fact, that was the main reason that I was supportive of the agreement. The provisions themselves don't seem to be all that more liberalizing than the NAFTA. Free traders should note the distinction between free trade and free trade agreement. This is a free trade agreement that exemplifies the managed trade nature of these trade agreements. The costs to comply, to qualify for the terms of the agreement are going to be much higher than they were under NAFTA. There's something called the rules of origin, where we require a certain amount of value to be added from the region, from Canada, Mexico, and the United States. Those requirements are much more onerous than they were before, particularly in auto production. I think the administration is trying to manage trade to the extent that it encourages producers to close factories in Mexico and reopen them in the United States. My big concern is that by raising the cost of complying with the terms to qualify for the agreement, you're going to chase production away. because the tariffs on automobiles is only 2.5%. So if the cost of complying to get the 0% tariff become too high, then producers are just going to go away. And I think it's quite possible we're going to see that. It's not the ideal trade agreement by any stretch.
What's the best argument for passing the USMCA? If you're a member of Congress, if you're somebody, let's say a moderate Republican maybe, who's on the fence about this, what's the best reason for voting yes?
You know, if you look at it chapter by chapter, sort of provision by provision, there are some areas where the USMCA is better than NAFTA. We have better rules regarding digital trade. It looks like enforcement of the agreement will be honored under the USMCA, where under NAFTA it was not. But there isn't a whole lot of extra liberalization. The U.S. market isn't opening any further. We didn't open up our services markets, neither did the Mexicans or Canadians. Government procurement commitments haven't really changed. But yes, relative to the threat of Trump withdrawing from NAFTA, which would have created a lot of problems, we're in a safer position now. So I'm straddling the fence right now as to whether or not I would say, okay, go ahead and vote for this thing, get this thing done, or not. What leads me slightly tilting toward passage is just to put the uncertainty to rest.
We are talking with Dan Eikenson. He is the Director of Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C. He joins us now on the phone. Dan, you were talking a little while ago about the higher requirements for this particularly impacts auto manufacturing, that it'll sort of raise some barriers. There's new requirements for how much steel that goes into cars has to be produced in the United States, for example, for those cars to move duty-free across national borders. This will affect a lot of manufacturing that goes on in Mexico. Without getting, you know, too deep in the weeds, there's a possibility here that this kind of backfires, right? The idea is bring jobs back from Mexico, bring manufacturing jobs back from Mexico. That sounds great, but there are some people who are worried about the fact that this could actually result in more jobs not coming back to the United States, but leaving Mexico and going elsewhere.
That's right. I think the administration is trying to sort of transparently make it easier for companies to set up shop in the United States to see the benefits of doing that, but complying with the costs of doing that, when you have to rejigger your supply chains, when you have to opt for inputs that are going to be more expensive to produce in order to get a lower duty rate or a no duty rate, you start thinking very carefully about whether it just makes sense to do all your production in Asia or in Latin America, or outside of the region.
Yeah, certainly there's a lot to dig through here. A lot of good and bad, probably some ugly in there too. The labor unions had a big influence in the final drafting of this with the House Democrats, so I'm sure there's a couple of rather ugly provisions in there because of that. A lot more that we could talk about. Unfortunately, we are out of time for today. That's Dan Eikenson from the Cato Institute. Dan, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure, Eric. Thanks for having me on.
And again, that is Dan Eikenson over at the Cato Institute. You can check out their work on trade policy and everything else, basically any issue that libertarians might care about at cato.org. You can check out our coverage at Reason Magazine of the USMCA and NAFTA and all the other trade policies that are happening in Washington, D.C. right now at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Bame. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Congressional Democrats and deep state bureaucrats have clearly attempted to reverse the results of the 2016 presidential election, and they should be held accountable. So says Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The irrational acceptance of many of the conduct of the FBI with the surveillance on an American citizen during the Trump campaign in 2016 and a myriad of other efforts on the part of the left to invalidate the 2016 election are mind-boggling, to say the least. My head is spinning from the deception, the dishonesty, the complete attempt to interfere with the presidential election. I took an oath of office as a United States Marine Corps officer in 1973. I am stunned by what I see today. That oath of office states, and I quote, "I do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I take this obligation freely without any mental reservations or purpose of evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office upon which I am about to enter. So help me God." Assad, end quote. The results of the alleged Russian interference, Operation Crossfire Hurricane, and the obvious spying on the presidential campaign, and the total interference from Nancy Pelosi and other members of the far left in the House of Representatives, have convinced me that we have at work within the House domestic enemies of the United States of America. When will we all say that we've had enough? Hillary Clinton in the third debate, and you want to see her remarks at 1 hour and 6 minutes of the debate of the presidential election season, expressed outrage when Donald Trump would not state that he would accept the results of the election. She proclaimed that peaceful transitions of government were the hallmark of our republic for the past 240 years. Apparently, Hillary's exhortation was dependent upon what she believed to be a foregone conclusion that she was going to be president. Since that November night in 2016, Clinton, Comey, Pelosi, Schiff, Nadler, and others of the far left have worked to continually drum up one fictitious charge after another against a sitting president. If the, and I quote, impeachment, unquote, hearings are not an attempt to overthrow a government of duly elected, according to the Constitution of the United States of America, I don't know what is. We are at a unique point in history. The people who freely elected a president are within the framework of a constitution are facing an historic moment in which the government is its own insurgency against the very leaders elected by the people. Our government has become so partisan over the past 20 years that it no longer enjoys the full faith and confidence of the American people. The 2016 election bears that out. Without that full faith and confidence, the nation is ungovernable. We must demand that the allegations by Clinton, Pelosi, Schiff, and Nadler be investigated to the full extent to get to the truth about the corruption in our federal government. The lack of trust in government will destroy our republic if not dealt with immediately. This crisis in government is at a breaking point. Uncharted territory will be forged with this investigation into abuses of power and other high crimes and misdemeanors on the part of Pelosi and her allies. Our nation is a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people. Without full transparency, full accountability, and full responsibility, the bickering of the past 20 years will become the way of a future. All the while, the critical problems facing our nation will go unresolved. Time is no longer on our side. To trust government is to have faith in government. Without trust, there is no faith. Without faith and trust, there is no United States. To respond to a nation in crisis after the Revolutionary War, our nation passed the Insurrection Act of 1807, which, while amended, is still in force to this day. When a nation reaches the point of insurrection, the power to deploy military forces in the nation can be used. But what occurs if the insurrection is by the bureaucracy against the people? No such event has occurred since the Revolutionary War, and our current laws are outdated. With the laws of the United States for things such as civil service and career bureaucracies, whose very existence is dependent upon maintaining the status quo, the dangers to that group of anyone who threatens to drain the swamp will be profound and likely cause a pointed, directed, and powerful response to protect the status quo, a reverse insurgency of sorts. Never before in the United States history has civil disobedience been used by the bureaucracy against it, the ones that it governs. The stakes are extraordinarily high. Our republic is at stake. Our liberty is at stake. Our Constitution and our Bill of Rights are at stake. President Target is the Trump today, but we, the people, are the objective of this insidious effort to undermine a government and our very religious freedoms and liberties that we cherish. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WBFD-AM in Bedford, Pennsylvania, KCBC-AM in Manteca, California, and WROV-FM in Ridgeway, Pennsylvania. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.